Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 6th of March. I've been looking forward to the show we're about to do for a couple weeks, ever since Rhonda sent me a message on this incredible discovery. Professor Herman Pfefferkorn, a professor in the Department of Earth and Environmental Science at the University of Pennsylvania, along with three Chinese scientists, unearthed an ancient ecosystem preserved by volcanic ash far beneath the coal mines around Wuda, China. He worked alongside these Chinese colleagues to make the discovery, and it's been coined Pompeii-like by researchers due to the uncanny resemblance to the events of the ancient city of Pompeii, which was buried under a mass of volcanic ash for over 1,700 years before being discovered in 1749. The ash in China allowed for a remarkable preservation of the plant life. Some plants fell almost directly where they had begun to grow nearly, get this, 300 million years ago. Our guest says it's marvelously preserved. We can stand there and find a branch with the leaves attached, and then the next branch, and the next branch, and the next branch, and then we find the stump from the same tree. That's really exciting. Professor Herman Pfefferkorn is with us now. His current research is late Paleozoic paleoclimatology based on the study of fossil plants, and he can spend the rest of his life, I'm sure, examining all the fossils that he discovered in China. We're going to be welcoming phone calls for him. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. He also says that this discovery elucidates the time before and the time after, and we'll ask him how that happens to be the case. We'd love to hear from you if you'd like to join our conversation. That would be just dandy. Professor Pfefferkorn, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hello, it's my pleasure.
I am so excited to talk to you. Rhonda gave me this article a couple weeks ago, and it just dumbfounded me. I put it on my Facebook page. I've been talking to people about it, saying, can you believe this discovery? You must have felt the same way when you made this discovery.
Yes, we did. This was exciting. We were going into the area to do some other work on a location that had been found before that was much less exciting. And we discovered this. And we realized what it was. And so we started the collection. And then as we were collecting, we realized that we could do quantitative work, that we could really figure out where which tree was standing, how the ecosystem worked.
Tell me why you were there in the first place. What were you looking at?
I had been introduced to a Chinese colleague who had done similar research to mine. So we had common interest, and he knew about a locality in the Wuda area in Inner Mongolia in China, which he wanted to work with me on. And so we arranged to go to the field to look at that locality. And on the way to the locality, we passed this volcanic tuff and recognized it for it was, because it hadn't been recognized before. The mining companies had just opened up some ditches so that we could get at it. So the mining, even though it was destroying it at the same time, made this available at the surface.
Did the miners know what they had discovered and get in touch?
No.
They did not.
No. Afterwards, we explained it to them, and they were very cooperative.
So you were, I don't even know how you, were you walking? Were you driving
along? Oh, we were walking, yeah. No, in geology, you drive, of course, as close as you can to an area you want to investigate, but then you have to walk.
And what did you see that captivated you right away?
It was the white rock. I mean, there are white rocks, but they aren't that common. And so I wanted to know what it is. I used my hammer to break some fresh pieces. I used my hand lens to look at it, and it became obvious to me that it was a volcanic tuff. And then we saw the plant fossils as we looked the tuff over, and they stick out. They are black or dark brown on this white tuff, so they stick out really. And we got all excited, and there were large pieces, and quite often when you find plant fossils, you find fragments, and here were these large pieces, branches with attached leaves and things like that.
Did you, when you immediately saw it, because of the nature of what you do, say, oh my gosh, this is millions of years old?
The age was still open at that time. The Chinese had done preliminary work for the mining industry, and they had put an age on, which was close to what we finally figured out, but we could refine it based on our find.
Mm-hmm. And then you started excavation of the area. How large an area, Professor Pfefferkorn?
Ultimately, we excavated 1,000 square meters. That's essentially an area, let's say, 30 feet by 300 feet. But we did this in three different areas because what we needed was we saw the tuff, which is about 2 feet thick, only in the cut. And we had to get the mining company to come with a power shovel and remove the rocks above it.
Mm-hmm.
So that we could dig down in it and really excavate an area. So these areas could not be, I mean, we were happy that we got the sizes we got, which were significant even in terms of the time spent to do the excavation.
Mm-hmm. And when you were looking at what you found, was this something that was in the realm of human comprehension, or were you looking at things that were so old that you really didn't even know what they were?
We knew for most of the things what they were, not for all. There are new things there, absolutely new things we found. But there has been work on fossil plants in North America, Europe, and also in China. In Europe for over 200 years, in North America for over 150 years, in China for essentially 80 years. So there is some a solid base of knowledge about the reconstruction of the most common plants. And actually, at that time, and I have to make that clear, China, Europe, and North America were all in the tropics along the equator.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, North America and Europe were in together in the large continent, the mega continent. China consisted of two smaller continents, let's say each half the size of Australia,
mm-hmm.
that were in the tropical ocean. And because the areas were all in the tropics, the flora has similarities, as you would find similarities between South America, let's say, Congo in Africa, and Indonesia today.
Mm-hmm.
So I recognize certain plants, even in their fragmentary state immediately, and then we found the larger pieces. But what was exciting is you find the larger pieces very rarely. So here we suddenly saw, for instance, an enigmatic plant group that doesn't even have an English name, has only the scientific name, that has been described essentially from Illinois, from the Czech Republic, and from Germany before, and a few from China. But we have suddenly the whole, essentially the whole tree, or the top of the tree with the leaves and the cones attached.
Oh, my gosh.
And in one case, we have the upper part of the tree, where the stem with the leaves attached, then come cones, then leaves again.
Oh.
So we see directly what they look like. And this is this rare group where we don't even know where they belong. I mean, there are in the literature several suggestions. So there isn't enough known yet. And we are working on it to figure out what's going on. And we have already published before some specialized publications and specialized scientific journals. For instance, we described one of these plants from this enigmatic group before. We elucidated some other finds that bothered us in the beginning. We looked at it and said, we have never seen this before. What's going on here? And then we found more and more and slowly worked it out.
You must have been in heaven.
Yes.
Now, there is a picture of what this area looked like. How did you, tell me what I'm seeing in the picture that I'm looking at. How did you extrapolate your find and then make this picture of what the area looked like? It looks kind of surreal.
It, The first thing is we made a map where we mapped the plants as we found them so that we knew where a tree of a special kind was growing and a second kind and so on. We looked at the parts we had and figured out what the whole plant would have looked like from the pieces that we had found, because the branches broke off, smaller trees toppled over and are lying there flat. And then we worked with an artist, and the artist is magnificent. But the version you see, I always joke that it's version 20. It's not even the first color version. I mean, we start with black and white. It's more than that. And we trained the artist. We discussed, and when I say we, I mean the Chinese colleagues and I. We discussed with the artist what we envisioned, but we also took him to a botanical garden where they had tropical plants, and we showed him what modern tropical plants look like and explained which features would be similar in the fossil plants and which would be different, so that the artist started to understand what we envisioned from what we had found. So the reconstruction is a marvelous cooperation between a scientist and the artist.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls. We're going to tell people that this will be posted on our Facebook page. Rhonda is doing that so you can see what we're talking about, because you'll be dumbfounded by the whole thing. It's just remarkable. And your scientific paper is online somewhere, Professor Pfefferkorn?
Yes. Actually, this one is freely available. It's in the public realm. So if somebody looks up the proceedings of the National Academy and does a search for Professor Wang or my name or Wuda, it should come up, and it is not restricted, as most publications are. It's freely downloadable.
And you talk about the fact that this elucidates the time before and the time after. Explain that to me. How does it elucidate that time?
Here we have a complete picture. We see how the ecology changes in a essentially flat landscape, which has no big ecological changes, but the flora is not the same everywhere. So we now have an understanding of the flora in the landscape. We want, of course, to understand change over time. So we are looking at earlier finds of fossil plants and later finds of fossil plants, but most are much less complete. So we find the parts of the plant, and now we have a reconstruction of one time slice. And if we find less complete information, we can compare that information with this one, and therefore can go much further in our conclusions.
Is it similar to, is it more remarkable, about as remarkable as the excavation of Pompeii?
Well, we compare it. It's similar. I mean, we know something about Roman history, and Pompeii itself doesn't tell us anything about historical changes, of course. It's a moment in time, but it tells us how the Romans lived, which is otherwise often not recorded, the everyday thing.
Right.
And therefore, if we read now in a Roman manuscript a description of some feature, we suddenly understand it, because in Pompeii it was found in place, how the people lived, how they used it, what they used in a kitchen, let's say.
Right.
Yeah. So even the images that the writers use can now be better understood.
Mm-hmm.
So in the same way, we find a fragment. Essentially, we have seen the whole plant. Now, even if we find a fragment, we can deduce what the plant looked like, which plant we are looking at. And as I said, we found totally new things.
Hmm. Yeah. And what about the mining company? Is there mining going on in this area? Does it need to be halted?
They actually halted the surface mining. So there is some of the tuff preserved for future excavations. And future generations. They are still having three deep mines in the area, but they are mining a different coal. So the surface mining was terminated because there were lots of coal fires. The coal ignited by itself in place after it was disturbed by the mining.
Oh.
And, of course, the fumes coming off the coal are not healthy. They are contributing to climate change. I mean, they are bad news. So they made a major effort, which helped us indirectly, to exterminate the coal fires and, at that time, mine the coal that was near the surface.
We welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is Professor Herman Pfefferkorn, and let me spell that last name for you in case you want to, and I hope you will, look this up on the internet. It's Pfefferkorn, professor in the Department of Earth and Environmental Science at the University of Pennsylvania, unearthed this ancient ecosystem, 3 million years old, preserved by volcanic ash beneath the coal mines around Wuda, China. Chinese colleagues helped in this discovery, and Wuda is W-U-D-A. If you search around, you will find information on this discovery. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. The pictures that we have and the story on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. I am Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. A busy political day today. The president is having a news conference, and that will be carried here a couple hours from now. NPR News special coverage of President Obama's news conference hosted by Jennifer Ludden. The president will focus on the situation in Syria, Iran's disputed nuclear program, the U.S. economy, and because it's a press conference, who knows what's going to be discussed today at noon here on the Ideas Network. It's also Super Tuesday, of course, and I want to remind you, as we have done with all of the primaries and caucuses, tomorrow at 9, we will examine what happened. Two guests, the State House News Bureau reporter for Ohio Public Radio and Television, and a professor of political science at Ohio State University. All right, let's go to phone calls for Professor Herman Pfefferkorn. Catherine in Ironwood, Michigan is our first caller. Hi, Catherine.
Well, good morning. I'd like to thank Wisconsin Public Radio for bringing us programs such as this, because this is wonderful.
You're welcome.
This is amazing, because I had right in front of me when the program came on, the January issue of Smithsonian Magazine with an article about a place in Nebraska called Ashfall Fossil Bed State Historical Park. And it's the same type of thing that the professor is talking about. And I don't have too much comment about it, except that it's a very fascinating article as his program. And I'll just recommend anybody to find this article and read it.
Are you familiar with this? Thank you. Thanks for the call.
I have not seen this article, but I'm familiar with the deposit. And in that case, animals are preserved. And that's a marvelous find, and it tells us about a much younger time, not 300 million years old. But in each of the cases where volcanic eruptions preserve something like this, it's a key to understanding the time interval. And this in Nebraska is, of course, especially exciting because the large vertebrates are preserved. That brings me to something we found in ours. We have so far found only one animal, but mostly plants. So actually, it also depends where the ash falls. We have not found the traps yet where the animals ran. Animals can get out of the way, the plants can't.
Hmm.
So in Nebraska, that's an area, as I understand it, where there was a water hole and a large rhino-sized animals congregated and were then trapped by the ash. While we were looking at a totally flat landscape, something like the northern plain of Sumatra, the island of Sumatra in Indonesia, really totally flat at near sea level.
And what was the animal you found?
It's a scorpion.
A scorpion?
Yeah. It looks, in our case, that the ash fall started slowly with a fine ash, perhaps for a few hours, and then came the big fall. I think that animals dash to places where there were ponds or little creeks or something like that. And even though the area we looked at is reasonably large, we did not find any channel or any pond or anything like that.
Hmm.
So we expect that the animals will be there. They try to get out of the way to hide or something like that.
And did this 300-million-year-old scorpion look like scorpions now?
Yeah.
Really?
They haven't changed that much.
Huh. Fascinating.
They are similar.
Thank you, Catherine, for the call. Melody in Washington Island. Hi.
Hi. I have a question, Professor Pfeffercorn. When things do not decay, when the volcanic ash preserves them so well, how do you determine the age? Does the radiocarbon dating work the same? Does the carbon decay despite the fact that the rest of the material does not?
Good question. Radiocarbon doesn't go that far back. The radioactive carbon is totally gone after about 70,000 years at the maximum. Often after 50,000 years, you can't measure anymore, depending on the method. So we are in a different realm. We did the age identification in two different ways. One is with the fossils themselves. The different strata that were laid down at the surface of the Earth are really stacked on top of each other. So through observation, you know which one is lower, which one is higher. The lower one, the one underneath, is the older one. So this is a relative age. And in the beds that have been laid down over the last 540 million years, the fossils change. So this has nothing, by the way, to do with theory. This was discovered totally pragmatically even before Darwin. Different beds have different fossils. And I used my knowledge of fossil plants from North America and Europe. And with that, I said already what the age was. But in the meantime, we got an isotope age. And in this case, the other elements were used. We use the mineral zircon, and in the zircon there are some radioactive elements that decay, and that date is specifically not yet published, but it confirmed what I had said based on the plants. So we use two methods to identify the age.
Thank you, Melody. Very much. You talk about this being at the beginning of a geological period called the Permian, and you've described it somewhat. Please describe it more extensively for us. What was going on then?
The Permian is the last time period of the Paleozoic, which means literally old life. And what happened during that time is that at the beginning of the Permian, there was an ice house climate. So actually, our flora, even though it's tropical, where you don't see much of that, occurs at the beginning of ice house climate, similar to the one we live in. And then by mid-Permian time, the ice house climate changed to a greenhouse climate. The climate became warmer and drier. And at the end of the Permian was the largest mass extinction on Earth.
Oh, my.
So that's, in a short, what happened during the Permian period. And we have something right at the beginning when there is a transition from greenhouse to ice house climate.
And do we know what caused the mass extinction?
The mass extinction, that is still being debated, but it becomes clear now that there was a truly major volcanic eruption, much, much larger than anything humans have experienced since humans have been on Earth, It was in Siberia, or what is today Siberia, and it went through coal seams and pumped huge amounts of CO2 and sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere. The ocean acidified very rapidly, and there was a 5-million-year time, it was very lengthy, when it was very difficult for life to be reestablished. There were few species that survived. They became small, actually, and it took a long time before life diversified again.
Mm. And what do we learn from that? Do you know all of this that most of us have no idea about? Do we learn something from that that's pertinent to 2012 and beyond?
Yes. For instance, one thing we want to understand is, of course, why does climate change occur on Earth? You see, we have the question now, how much do humans influence climate change right now? For that, we have to understand, of course, what climate changes occurred in the past due to natural processes, and which processes did it. We are living in an interglacial of an ice house climate at the moment, and we understand very well and have understood since the 1930s why we have glacials and interglacials. But for instance, we do not yet understand why the Earth climate flips at times from ice house to greenhouse or greenhouse to ice house climate.
Mm-hmm.
And we are trying, I mean, I'm not working on this principal question. I'm trying to define how the vegetation is influenced when these climate changes occur. And look at that. For the last time, we had similar conditions. You see, the ice house climate we are living now is about 35 million years old. And the last one before that was 300 million years ago. In between, the whole time the dinosaurs lived, we had greenhouse conditions on Earth. Mm-hmm. The dinosaurs never experienced an ice age.
Hmm.
So we have to look back in deep time to find another time when a change from ice house to greenhouse happened. And this could happen in the future. I mean, we are heading that way, and we have to know what that mean. What would the changes be?
Hmm. And the dinosaurs, before I go back to phone calls, could not have made it through an ice age? They couldn't have lived during an ice age?
Well, we don't know. They never experienced it. It was never tested out.
Oh,
I mean,
okay.
Some of them might have survived in the tropics. But the dinosaurs, some dinosaurs migrated into polar regions during the summer, migrated out of them during the winter.
Hmm.
Because the winter was night. I mean, maybe the puddles froze over a little bit, but that was about it. I mean, it was so warm that large trees could grow in the polar regions.
Hmm.
There were no ice caps.
Mm-hmm.
During greenhouse time, you have no or only very, very small ice caps.
Melody, thanks for your call. Jeff is our next caller. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good morning. Excellent show. Love your guests. Great information. Listening to public radio makes you smarter. My question for your guest is, does he and his colleagues feel that finding any of these, I guess the word would be non-indigenous plants in places where they don't belong, is your guest feel that they could point to a one-time polar shift? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Jeff.
A one-time? I didn't catch that.
A one-time polar shift.
Oh, I see. No. We know where the poles were. The continents were, of course, migrating. And this was originally described as the poles moving. But we know now that the rotational pole of the Earth does not move. The continents move. So the continents were certainly in a different position than they are in now, so that, for instance, North America, where we are, was everywhere within 10 degrees of the equator, and the equator was running through the U.S. area. but it was not a sudden shift at all. I mean, there were it was going back and forth actually over geologic time. We had certain times when we had ice ages. We had other times when we had greenhouse.
Thank you. And let me give our phone number again, 800-486-8655. In case you're wondering what in the world we're talking about, because you've just tuned in, it is something very unique we're talking about. It's a remarkable discovery in coal mines around Wuda, China. And our guest made this discovery along with three Chinese colleagues, unearthing an ancient ecosystem preserved by volcanic ash, much like Pompeii, although it is much, much older than Pompeii. It is 3 million years old, and he's describing what he found there and what the Earth was like at that particular point in time, and what it tells us about today. And it's just a fascinating, fascinating find. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email, if you would like to use that, is talk@wpr.org. Please go to our Facebook page. Rhonda has posted pictures of what this area would have looked like 3 million years ago and more information about Professor Pfefferkorn's remarkable find, find of a lifetime, I'd say. Unless, you know, who knows, you may find something even more exceptional, but I don't know how you can. Professor, this is pretty big, isn't it?
Yes, yes, indeed.
Yeah. So are you going back? Can you excavate more? Do you want to do that?
We will go back this fall. I'm actually meeting my colleague in Los Angeles this coming weekend at a small scientific meeting, and we will make the plans for later this year. We are continuing the work. There's still lots of work to be done on the specifics, reconstructing all the plants, describing them, putting them in the literature so that other colleagues can compare with them.
More phone calls momentarily. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, an interesting question. Should Scotland be an independent country? Today at noon, the president is having a press conference, hasn't had one, I guess, since November, so he'll be covering a wide range of issues. We will cover that today at noon. Back to phone calls for Professor Pfefferkorn, and Mary in Sussex is next. Hi, Mary.
Hi, happy to be on, and I have to say I'm a huge petrified wood collector, so this is really an exciting subject. My question is, what does the actual petrified trees look like? How is it mineralized? Is there a lot of color to the wood? Has the wood rings been preserved in stone? Just give a physical description of what it looks like.
Very good question. Actually, in the tuff, the wood is not mineralized. It's coalified. So actually, the trees were rotting in place, and the tuff also then slid into the center of them. So many of the trees have a coaly film on the outside and are filled with tuff themselves. So it's a different type of preservation. The smaller parts, let's say branches, leaves, they are just flattened. It's not mineralized in this area. Of course, there's lots of mineralized wood in China. Actually, in a city near Wuda is one of the major collectors of fossilized wood, and it was a pleasure to look at his collections of stunning materials. But in our area, no. That preservation does not occur.
And I just have one thing to add. There is a geological show at Washington County Fairgrounds the end of April, Kettle Moraine Geological Society. So if you want to see petrified wooden fossils, people are welcome to come to that.
Great.
Yeah,
all right. Great. Send us more information. We'll post it on our Facebook page, Mary.
Super. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the call. Doug in Mukwonago. Hi.
Yeah, I was just curious. You were sort of describing the state of preservation. Did you find any seeds? And are they preserved to the point that you could actually somehow grow some of these plants out of them?
The first thing is, yes, there are seeds. There are two groups of seed plants, the cordites trees and the pteridosperms, both extinct now. However, the seeds are totally coalified. there is no trace of the original organic matter left, so you could not revive them in any way, shape, or form.
Okay.
Sorry,
well, that's what I was wondering. Thank
yeah.
you.
No, good question, but
yeah, that
no, that's not in it. It's qualified. It did not burn.
Is it possible to extract DNA from these?
No.
No. No.
It's
okay.
denatured. It's essentially the, chemically speaking, everything, every organic matter there was reduced. O and OH groups were removed. The chain length changed. So we are talking different substances.
Thank you.
Hmm. It's too bad in a way, I was thinking, although you'd hate for it to be a big tourist attraction, but imagine, come and see the world as it was 300 million years ago. A lot of people would go, wouldn't they?
Yeah, this is not a tourist area. I mean, we and some other colleagues who were looking after the coal fires and to extinguish them, we were essentially the only non-Chinese who were in the area.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is off the beaten path. This is a mining area in the middle of a semi-desert, and the real desert is not far away. Hmm. This is at the edge of the desert.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Doug, for your call. Kenneth in Janesville, hi.
Where were we when all of this was going on, is my question.
Where were we?
Yes.
Well, humans didn't exist at all. The vertebrates that existed at that time when this happened were mostly amphibians. So you have to imagine salamanders up to the size of alligators.
Ooh.
And there were the first reptiles were coming in at about that time. I mean, life in terms of vertebrates on Earth consisted really of large amphibians and small amphibians, of course, and the first reptiles were around.
Hmm. So not much.
No,
not much,
the reptiles were at that time still small lizards. Shortly thereafter, there were larger ones. But that was it for the vertebrates.
Huh.
So the only thing flying, for instance, in the sky were insects. And there were insects very much like dragonflies, which had a wingspan of a foot.
Woo!
Yes. And there was a millipede running around in those swamps that could get 3, 4, 5 feet long. And a foot wide.
Oh, my goodness. Ooh. Thank you, Kenneth, for the call. Carlton in Eagle River, hi.
Hi. This is a very interesting program, so thank you. I wonder if the professor could comment a little bit about the range that he expects have happened in sea levels from these ice house periods to the greenhouse periods and possibly talk about the number of cycles that we've gone through. From this ice house to greenhouse periods.
Yes, we have first to distinguish between the glacials and interglacials. So when we say ice age, we often mean the glacial times when the glaciers were very widespread, and the last glacial ended about 15,000 years ago. So geologically speaking, rather recently. And at that time, let's say 25,000 years ago, the glaciers were, of course, in Wisconsin. They were in northern Pennsylvania. They covered a good part of the North American continent. And we are living in an interglacial. The glaciers have retreated, but there are still large glaciers on Greenland. And there are, of course, two very large ones on Antarctica. Ice house climate means that there are large glaciers at all. And so the glacial interglacials, they happen at the moment on a 100,000-year cycle. So we understand that quite well. And this has to do with the way the Earth moves, and I would like to call it in a simplistic way, they are regular irregularities of the path of the Earth. In other words, it means which part of the Earth, which half sphere, gets a little bit more sunlight during which season. But the greenhouse versus the ice house conditions, those are longer periods. For instance, in the last 540 million years, we had on Earth principally four ice house times. There was a short one, probably only about a million years long, in what we call the end of the Ordovician. And that would have been, if you want numbers, we work with the words, which are quite precise to us, but this would have been about 443 million years ago. Another one was in the late Devonian, that would have been about 365 million years ago. Then we had the one in the Carboniferous and Permian, which I'm studying, and then we had our present one. So there were four times when there was ice house climate, and in between were much longer times of greenhouse climate.
Mm-hmm. It's really not very many when you consider how many years we're talking about.
No, but I mean the ice house times were very long. Even the one we are in, it became very intensive shorter time ago, but it started really about 35 million years ago.
There were a number of firsts that were associated with your incredible discovery here. I read somewhere, is this true, that this was the first forest reconstruction in Asia for any time interval?
Yes. I mean, we introduced this method, and we expect now other colleagues to do the same. So there are earlier reconstructions, but they are highly conceptual.
Mm.
In other words, out of fragments, you can, of course, envision what it might have been, but you don't have the ecosystem. It's like a botanical garden where you plant things around. So not bad. I mean, we have to do that too. But and some of the botanical gardens I call botanical gardens in space and time. I have seen reconstructions, not just in Asia, actually. I'm talking about one in North America, which has now been dismantled, where there were plants shown together which in life never met because one was extinct before the other originated.
Oh, interesting.
So that's what I mean with conceptual. So
right,
conceptually,
right.
It was still, it gave you an impression, but it was not the reconstruction of a real ecosystem in one place. So that was one first.
And then the first with, I don't know how you pronounce this, as dominant groups, the N-O-E-G-G-E-R-A-T-H-I.
Yeah, the Nurgeratiales.
Say that again.
Nurgeratiales.
Yeah, I never would have been able to say Nurgeratiales.
Nurgeratiales, I mean, Nurgeratiales. It's named after the early scientist who lived in the city of Bonn in Germany called Nurgerat.
Mm. And what is, that's the dominant tree?
Yeah, these are small trees, and the leaves are like cycad leaves or a little bit like palm leaves, even though they have nothing to do with these groups. But they had cones with spores.
Hmm.
So they have a mixture of characteristics that do not occur in any other group. And, I would describe them, but we have to prove that. This isn't proven yet. I would call them a sister group to the ferns, even though they look completely different.
And we have found them elsewhere? Were those the ones you were talking about we found in Illinois?
Yes.
Oh.
I worked on them in Illinois 30 years ago, but not that well preserved. We had fragments, and from that we deduced what would belong together. They are known from the Czech Republic, from Germany. Small pieces have been found in Pennsylvania. So there are a few places where fragments have been found, but we have the whole plants. And we have actually three different species which belong to different genera.
Oh, my. And when did they become extinct?
They became extinct at the end of the Permian. They didn't make it through that mass extinction.
Huh. Let's go. Thanks, Carlton, for your call. Pete in La Crosse. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen, Professor. Sir, you've seen lots of environmental disasters, species extinction, etc., and I'm hoping for us you can extrapolate what the Earth will look like after we're gone and our species-induced extinction runs its course. How long is it going to take for the Earth to recover, both in terms of climate and species diversity, etc., after we're done with what we're up to?
A good question. We can only look at mass extinctions that have happened in the past due to natural causes. And it depends very much how fast the climate gets into a normal mode. The one in the Permian, at the end Permian, was the most serious one because it took actually several million years before the Earth was really populated in a similar way. One measure says 5 million years. So sometimes these repopulations have happened over periods of 500,000 years or 1 million years. But at times it has taken a long time before an equilibrium in the conditions was achieved by the Earth systems.
Thank you, Pete, so much for your call. And we have time for maybe one or two more calls. If you'd like to join us, our lines have been jammed. You can get through now. Professor Herman Pfefferkorn is our guest, and we're talking about the remarkable discovery that he and Chinese colleagues made beneath the coal mines around Wuda, China, a 300-million-year-old resemblance to what life was like there, because it's been preserved because of the volcanic ash. It was an incredible discovery. Our number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Has this discovery, we picked it up, but I'm wondering if this discovery has really made its way through the regular community all over the world, because it's so significant, Professor Pfefferkorn. Is it just beginning to become widely known what it is that you found?
Yes. I got reactions, emails from colleagues who saw the publication. But then it also takes sometimes a little bit of time. And now, of course, after reading a scientific publication, every colleague who works on something similar starts to think, and writing manuscripts takes time, so they will incorporate these citations in their manuscripts. So that takes some time to see in the scientific process how it influences the thinking. It certainly has influenced our thinking and the one of the colleagues we are working with. Actually, we will present this at the end of the week in Los Angeles in a small meeting, where there are colleagues who are working with similar problems, and there will be discussion. I have presented it also, and my Chinese colleague, at a meeting just before the publication came out. You can do that, of course. You tell colleagues already some of these things. And so we had scientific discussions, and we will see, and it will certainly influence the thinking and how people go about it, colleagues go about the work.
I would imagine. Well, congratulations to you. It's just, it's marvelous what you've discovered, and it was a great thrill to speak with you. I mean that very sincerely. It just was.
And I thank you very much. It was a pleasure, and it was nice to answer the questions of the...
Good. I'm glad you felt that way. Our guest this hour, Professor Herman Pfefferkorn, professor in the Department of Earth and Environmental Science at the University of Pennsylvania. His current research is late Paleozoic paleoclimatology based on the study of fossil plants. And boy, did he find a lot to study for that other scientists will be studying for years and years and years to come. It is a discovery that we have outlined on our Facebook page. So if you, after hearing this conversation, want to know more about what we're talking about, it's the Kathleen Dunn Show. There will be pictures there. What a story. Well, that was so much fun. I hate to let it go. I want to keep talking about it. But I must tell you that we have a few things. We couldn't be as far away from 300 million years ago when I make these announcements. One is the president is having a news conference 12 o'clock today. We will be carrying it here on the Ideas Network. It's been a while since he's had an hour-long news conference, I understand. And then tonight at 7, this is Super Tuesday, of course, we'll be bringing you NPR News special coverage of Super Tuesday. Robert Siegel will be the host. Live results from each Republican contest and, of course, political analysis, speeches, and more. Tomorrow at 9, the Super Tuesday results will be the focus of our conversation, and our guests will be from Ohio Public Radio, and we'll also have a professor of political science from Ohio. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for this terrific show.